Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for Beyond the Mekong. And with me today is James Gomez. James is a former Singaporean politician and he was the founder of Asia Center. And they promote democracy. They look after many a civil society organization and are quite strong in the background. James, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Luke. Happy to be on the program. I've been following your podcast, and it's great this time to be actually on your show.
Oh, thank you very much. You've had a recent report out, which was published in the Kyoto Review of Southeast Asia, Eroding Electoral Integrity, Reasons for Democratic Backsliding in Southeast Asia. Can you give us a roundup on democracy in Southeast Asia? I don't think anyone would doubt that it's been caned over the last 10, 15 years. What's your view?
Sure, Luke. You know, at Asia Center, we look at issues of democracy and human rights. And, you know, it got us thinking. Here we are sitting in the region and we look at all the global indexes that pronounce the state of democracy, and if you look quite closely at Asia, Southeast Asia in particular, you'll find that the numbers aren't great, Luke. I mean, they have actually been sliding over the years. So we started looking at those numbers and we scratched our head and we thought, what more can we say about why all of this happening? Mm-hmm. And then we looked at the state of elections and the integrity of elections, and we said, aha, now that's where the problem is. So this special review, collection of essays in the Kyoto Review, looks at kind of the rationale behind why democracy has been on the back foot and sliding, not in a good way, in Southeast Asia. And what we found out was it's the elections, mate. That's not going very well. So in the countries that we surveyed in the special issue, that's Cambodia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, and Myanmar, we saw the key issue is that there has been a reversal of the electoral process. Most of these countries at some point or time were either pressured, yep, or they came to their own senses that perhaps independent, free and fair election might be the way to go.
Indeed, fact, yeah. I remember those days.
Yeah, it is the way to go. And the elites who were having a grip over the power kind of relented and said, okay, here we have the pressure from international community, here we have the pressure from our own people, so okay, we'll step back and make the election system a little bit fairer. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the now. As the election system loosened up and became slightly equitable, these very elites who said yay to the process opening up and going down the path of free and fair election,
yep,
suddenly find themselves losing their grip. And when it was quite clear they might lose their grip indefinitely and perhaps even get chucked out, mm-hmm, they then change their minds. So what we actually now see, and this is what accounts for the democratic backsliding in Southeast Asia, is these very elites who said yes to electoral reform are now undoing all those steps towards a positive reform in order to gain back their grip over the political process. And that's why the region, right, is on the back foot.
Do you think it came as a rude shock to them that they were not as popular as they thought they were?
You know, popularity is not really, I mean, it's great to have, but, you know, even if they are not popular, I think they always cherish their ability to have control over all elements of the political landscape. So the electoral process is one, the other big one is the media, and I would throw in a third, which is the space for civil society.
Right.
When they have a sense that they have the control or beaten back each of these three variables, and there are some more, you know, independent judiciary, a competitive political party landscape, mm-hmm, they get a sense that well, even if I'm not popular, so what? I control all the levers of power. Surely I'm going to be returned either through an unequal and unfair electoral system or otherwise. So they weren't gunning for popularity. I mean, if they are popular, great, but if not, control over the levers of power was key.
Right, so control is paramount, popularity is, well, it's nice if you can get it, but it's not that much of a concern.
No, absolutely right. And of course, they massage and manipulate popular outcome for their benefit. Mm-hmm. And this is not done through sound policy solutions. Instead, what you see across the region is a populist giveaway type approach. Now, whether you are looking at the handouts that Prabowo has recently announced in the run-up to the elections and now
This is in Indonesia.
He's trying to give out incentives. So what you see across the region also is to manipulate popularity through handouts. And it's almost like equivalent to food stamps, that you give out. But the purpose of the food stamp in years past was to really help a very small segment of the population that were down and out. So, you know, the approach of policymakers in those jurisdictions was really to the 10%, the 15% of the population that really needed genuine help, and that's where food stamps work. But if you come to the region, it's not about that small amount. More than half the population is getting some kind of stamps, voucher, rebates, incentives. So ruling elites have to dish out this kind of incentives just to ensure their people can survive.
Right. Regardless of how popular they are, regardless of how much control they have, and if they're going to claim to have control over that country, they still have to provide jobs. They still have to maintain standards of living and, where possible, improve those standards of living.
You're absolutely right. But you see, where they are at is they are unable to generate jobs for their own people. In fact, jobs are so little. These very jobs that are in the different jurisdictions, whether they're in Cambodia, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Philippines, it's also being sought after by other people who are not from those jurisdictions, guest workers, nomads, this, that, the other.
Yeah.
So the limited jobs in a particular national jurisdiction is also being competed for from those from without. So this raises the bar and makes the issue a little bit more complex. Mm-hmm. So because they are not able to generate jobs and because the cost of living is extremely high, we are shifting to handouts, rebates as an option. Something I think is not going to be sustainable.
Right, because, I was just going to add that when people don't have enough to eat, and these days poverty is not quite what it was, and there's a lot more kids around who are educated and looking for jobs, and when they can't get what they need, they're more likely to protest. And if they're likely to protest, that's going to challenge the control of the government, and they will react.
Yeah, and react in a very hard way. And this is the experience we have seen in Thailand, for example, where those who have asked for reform, you know, whether it's political reform or other forms of reform, the crackdown is pretty hard, to the point that the crackdown is not only directed at youths, and because youths are politically aware a lot more younger, they are all bordering to the age of children.
Right.
So you have the state now not only trying to knock off youth in the age group in which youth fall, because those coming out to the streets and coming online are even much younger than international age gap or width of youth, you really see also children. And the state in or the elites in these countries or the powers that be are also failing to make that distinction. And so children are also now swiped up in that move to cull any form of resistance against the status quo.
Your choice of countries is interesting. Obviously, you've chosen half the Asian countries which have some kind of democracy, or democracy in Malaysia and Indonesia, and perhaps Singapore, Philippines. I don't know about thriving, but it's certainly there, and it underpins the system and government. But you also included Myanmar. Why was that, given the state of that country and the civil war, which has escalated since the military ousted the government in 2021, and certainly the military is well on the back foot?
Yeah, we included Myanmar simply because since day one from the 2021 coup, the rationale which it was the NLD was fraudulent in its victory.
Right.
It was all about elections. And the very premise that the junta articulated was, look, we need to do this because the past election was a fraud. That's their point of view. And therefore, we'll have to do this, and then we'll call elections ASAP. It's been, what, 3, coming to 4 years now, and no election has been signed because every 6 months the state of emergency is renewed and elections are postponed because the timing and the security reason is not right. For us, we included that in our discussion in this collection of the Kyoto Review simply because it also speaks to that process of dismantling an electoral system, which was, although far from fair, was on a slow march towards giving participants a little bit more equity in the electoral process than there was much, much before.
Right.
But what we see in my case, once the junta has taken over, it has introduced a range of legislations and manipulations that bring the elections back to where it was before, unfree and unfair.
Right.
And that's the kind of election it's peddling that it wants to hold.
Right, but in 2025. Do you remotely think that's possible, that the military can hold an election in Myanmar given the current state of play?
Well, based on how they have done their census and what the census tell us, so if you do a forensic on the census data, what you will see is they couldn't do the census in the periphery provinces or states, because that's where most of the tension and the ethnic groups are. But they have been able to do the census some places like Yangon, Mandalay, and a few other cities. So if you do a forensic and you have a good sense of what the census tell you, then the logic, and this is a logic that has been articulated by some,
right,
that Myanmar might go for a, some form of a staggered elections over only certain areas or provinces or states. So that's what the census tell us of the possibility. We are trying to read how the junta might operate. But whether it'll come to that will really depend on, you know, the international community, which has to call out the sham elections, including all the Myanmar activists, both in the country and outside, who are also, you know, don't want any credit or credulence given to this sham election effort. But at the same time, also to be quite clear what the junta is really trying to do, because I think we need to track them and we need to know what they're up to and also to be able to kind of pre-read the game. So in this collection, that's what we intended to do on that piece of Myanmar.
It's kind of paradoxical in that here we have, the junta is a good example in Myanmar, that you have these political parties and governments that control these countries, and the elections are not free and fair. The courts manipulate the results, the parties where they can manipulate the outcomes, the separation of powers is pretty much all but ignored. Yet these leaders and politicians seem to hold out the concept of holding a vote, the elections, as legitimizing them. As an outsider who's watched this for decades, one becomes somewhat incredulous at the attitude towards elections by, we could name the leaders if we want, but I think we're trying to keep this discussion a little bit above that. But do you understand what I'm driving at? I mean, I also think many people in Southeast Asia, they believe in democracy. They think their countries should be thriving under a democracy, and they're being denied that.
Luke, you're absolutely right. If I can, you know, sort of speak directly to your listeners and bring an example from university.
Yeah.
I mean, we know the universities are kaput. We know the courses, you know, don't impart the knowledge that young people need for themselves to do good for society, to have critical thinking and value, as well as perhaps, you know, contribute to the economy as well. It's not working. The university is broken. But parents cannot help themselves. They still will spend that hard-earned dollar to shove their children into universities, and young people go into these courses for 3 to 4 years. Many of them not very impressed on the learnings they get at those institutions, often very much on the phone. I've witnessed it firsthand, being at the university as an academic researcher and lecturer myself, sitting in firsthand. The system is broken, but parents still send their children to universities, and children, young people still go to university to spend that much of money, spend 3-4 years, and then come out and realize, hey, I don't have the skills or the EQ to get myself a job, and jobs are scarce. In the same way, the election or the electoral system is also broken because it is not sensitive to the voter needs and their cries for expression.
Right.
Yeah. See, what I get a sense across the region is the voters want something more beyond alternative policies. Yes, they want your head screwed on correctly. They want you to articulate good policies, alternative policies that will help them. But at the same time, voters also want representatives that can grip and hold the existing elites accountable. And that narrative is not coming out, and the system is not allowing alternative parties and individuals to come. Now, voters want that. They just don't not only want alternative policies, but they also want to hold the elites accountable. And they want to go beyond you know, receiving food stamps and handouts to survive. People want to thrive. People want to thrive. People want to have more. They want to have a sense of achievement, a sense of progress. But I think the elites in power can do no more than widen the food stamp circulation approach to more than the initial small sum that previous forms of states and jurisdiction did before. I mean, when food stamps were a kind of a short-term solution, but over here, it has become a handout approach. And I think that's where the nub is.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is important, because people who live in these Asian countries have moved beyond where they were 10, 15, 20 years ago, when you would have a leader who could fly out to a remote area and hand out sacks of rice, cartons of cigarettes, food parcels, and everyone would be lined up, and the leader would be standing there as a photo opportunity with the government-run television stations sending out their crews, and it would all be like, wow, look how good I am. Look what we're doing for the people. Meanwhile, the miserable sods who are relying on handouts of rice, they don't want to be there. They just want a better life.
Absolutely. And that's something they're not getting. And I think as the years go by, it's going to be harder and harder. I mean, the economies are broken.
Yep.
Restaurants are being shut. everyone is relying on tourists who don't have the extra dollar to spurge.
And tourists are economic. And tourism has changed. Sorry, go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. I mean, you're right. I mean, tourists have changed in the sense that you have economical tourists who spend less. They want more bang for their buck, and just short-term visits. But over to you. I mean, you know.
No. Well, I just think what I'm driving at is that the economies have fundamentally changed since COVID, and the kids who were the backpackers 20 years ago just aren't coming anymore, and the sense of travel, I think, has disappeared, and these governments are trying to rebuild an economy, as you said, based around tourism. They desperately want the foreign dollars, but they're not coming anymore. They all have smartphones. They live their lives through their smartphones. They don't. The desire to travel, what people want, seems to be undergoing a fundamental shift, and travelling to Southeast Asia simply to bolster the local tourism industry is not on their agenda the way it once, well, I won't say it once was, but certainly travelling to Southeast Asia was an enormous chunk of the economy for many of these countries for a long, long time. But that just, it's not happening anymore.
Right, and then so they will have to shift. So it's not just tourists. Now they are looking at retirees, students, you know, spouses,
right,
of local residents or citizens. So just to stretch, where more can I grab the foreign dollar from?
Right.
And as soon as you open up your visa system and all of that, and when you have people from other jurisdictions coming through, they are not there. I mean, simply because they can't afford to put dollars in your economy, then what they really want is, look, I'm coming from a difficult place myself.
Mm.
Can I get a few dollars from here?
Yep.
And then suddenly there's competition, and then that makes it harder for him.
Well, I think that the authorities in Bali were talking about imposing a tourist tax because they seem to think that that would be more likely to attract people with more money and they would get more bang for the buck. But I really don't understand how imposing a tax on people is going to attract more money through tourism.
You know, people with money, you know, they're usually very comfortable where they are. They have the bells and whistles and all the plush stuff. So they can't be asked to travel. Yeah, they'll go around the corner to a nice restaurant, quality ambiance, and they live well, all of that. So they, you can't ask them to drag themselves all the way and look at some crumbling building or look at peeling paint or,
you know, right.
Some structure.
Yeah, like old buildings and ruins that have been advertised ad nauseum for the last 20 years. A lot of people have already been, well, those who wanted to go anyway.
Yeah, or just watching on a video.
Sure.
Many people do. Well, yeah.
Yeah. What do these governments need to do in terms of their economies? Because they live in fear of an electoral backlash. That brings out the control freak in them, which means to avoid this, they fundamentally have to improve standards of living, which is not happening. And in terms of economic growth, everything seems to be based on what we used to do. And what we used to do no longer seems applicable.
I mean, the current lot, you know, across the region, right? Mm. I mean, they're kind of simply bankrupt with ideas. I mean, they literally sold all their assets or state assets anyway to monetize it for themselves and their children.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes with a negative backlash, which means your economy is overrun by somebody else, which means your people are not getting the kind of quality life and, you know, aspirational desires moving forward. So they can only put tape over the wounds and the holes by giving out handouts. So they really don't have solution. So asking this lot to come up with an idea for the very problem they have caused, for me, would not be the way to go. But I think one need fresh perspectives, both from national and beyond.
There also seems to be a heavy reliance on China. I mean, it's been going on for a while. The Chinese splashed billions around the region through the Belt and Road Initiative. That has all dried up. The Chinese show no signs of coming back. What tourists are coming out of China is limited, but there's still this hankering for, you know, oh, when are the Chinese coming back? What can we do for you, sir? It's subservient for a start, which I find particularly annoying, but this is what I mean by in terms of what they've been relying on for economic growth to secure their power base. It's not there anymore. The money's not there. And what do they do?
No, the Chinese are not spending so much in terms of the tourists, you know, dollars, and they are very prudent and economic travelers. They all got giddy with the possible perception that they could get some money or big returns from investing in properties in the region. If you just look at Cambodia, if you look at Phnom Penh, the Chinese would have chucked in some money, you know, in the last 3 to 5 years.
Yep.
Letting go their property at 5, 10, 15, even up to 20% below the 25% even below the rate that they paid for.
Exactly.
So what happens, so what's happening in Phnom Penh is it's the locals, you know, the locals, the middle, upper middle class, you know, who got a few extra dollars. They are the ones who are buying all these properties that are being, they've never been occupied. They're let go at, you know, percentages below what they initially paid for. And these are being picked by the upper middle class, the locals. So that's where you have. Now, given that the China market is already kind of dried up or thin, so there's a pivot towards India, South Asia in particular. I'm not sure, maybe for an initial run, you may get a few more warm bodies and filling up rooms, hotels, and so on. But the Indian and South Asian tourists are also not big spenders generally. They travel in packages or they always spend less.
Well, even when the Chinese were at their height in terms of numbers and inundating the region's tourist attractions, the big complaint then was that they don't spend that much money, not like the Westerners. They don't go into local bars and restaurants. And when they do spend money, it's on a Chinese-run bus company that will take them to a Chinese-owned restaurant or bar and operating through Chinese tour operators. And everything was kind of geared for the Chinese companies that have been set up to handle Chinese tourists, and not much of that money was actually going around in the local economy, and that led to a lot of complaints.
Yeah, with the Indians, it's no different. If you just go to Thailand, to the Pattaya area, you know, I mean, the number of Indian bars and restaurants that has come up is exponential.
Right.
So again, the money sort of goes round back in some way to Indian business owners or their proxies, so you come back to the situation. Because ultimately, what we need to understand with the tourism from China and India is really they want to consume things that they are familiar with, whether it's spicy mala food or vegetarian Indian food, but they come away from where they are simply to enjoy a sense of freedom, to be away from prying eyes and just to do things literally. I mean, you get a sense of it. You go to Pattaya and you look at some of the entertainment complexes, the events there, the tourists just get a sense of freedom or get a hair down in a manner they can't do back home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they don't also want to pay too much for it. So I think that's what we are stuck with now.
Right, okay, so we're stuck with a poor tourism outlook. The economies are suffering. Donald Trump in power and his tariff regime is could cause all sorts of havoc in terms of other exports like garments. You know, the word is Chinese factories are looking at moving out to avoid taxes, but I think we could all see the day when Trump is simply going to impose 20% tariffs on countries like Cambodia or Thailand because China is using it as a base to produce goods. Gazing into your crystal ball, how do you see things panning out over the next 5 years in terms of governments and their ability to maintain power, but at the same time try and get the economies up and running even just a little bit better?
Yeah, I think we're going to see elections as a performance. It's not really going to return the results of the voters. So elections would be performance. It's broken, but it will still be used. I think the general level of frustration and a sense of lack of empowerment will be felt by citizens. Mm-hmm. Who have been traditionally told they are the ones who have the power to change government. But I think you're going to also see a large movement of people internally in the region and people coming from abroad as well. So it will also very much diversify populations and representation.
Right.
That cannot be pushed through an election system, because if you go to a place like Singapore, where yep. you have nearly 6 million people and a touch above 40% not Singaporeans, and you're literally just bordering above 50% of the population who are citizens, new, past and present. So the number of people who are actually participating in the elections is substantially small. But then you will have to run the economy for everybody else, society. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be an issue as well.
Right.
And then, and then coupled with it, high cost of living, yep. inability to generate income, and that's all, you know, then throw a dollop of AI that will take away jobs and make redundancies. Yeah, things are not looking very good.
Right. One of the drivers of the next 5 years, you seem to be saying, could be immigration and a lot more people moving around the region. And as we know in the West, that's a double-edged sword, in that immigration does bring economic growth, but the welcoming arms of the locals in terms of migrants coming in, well, they're not that welcoming anymore.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, an impact on the quality of life, the aspirational desire of people. Getting ahead. So you're talking about overpopulation, access to limited resources. The malls are crowded. There's not enough public transport space for you to jump in. Then
yep.
The clash of cultures and civilization. It takes a while for people to get used to each other and the human condition before we learn to be comfortable, love and respect each other. It takes a while, but if you just throw everybody in a mad rush, that settling down period is not there.
Right.
So I think, yeah, that's the potent mix we are getting into.
It sounds very much like the heydays of Southeast Asia are long gone, and it's going to be a long haul back for a region that wants to see itself as a thriving and engaging part of the world.
That is so, but at the same time, you know, the human spirit is also, you know, unpredictable and innovative, so you never know in the dice of circumstances what kind of innovation, courage and novelty that we will see,
mm-hmm.
that can also bring us forward, you know. So I think with difficulties come opportunities and new ways of thinking, and that is also something we need to kind of look out for.
On that note, James Gomez, thank you very much. It's been an interesting chat, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
Sure, Luke, and thanks for having me over this time.
Been great. Thank you.